From Iowa Public Radio News, this is The Exchange. I'm Alex Hoyer, in for Ben Kiefer. Start today's show with the threat of flooding in Des Moines. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is planning to lower an inflatable dam at Sailorville Lake, which will send water over an emergency spillway. When that happens, the water in the Des Moines River will rise, and there are concerns about flooding. We'll get an update from Des Moines Public Works Director Bill Stowe. And later in the show, we'll talk about Iowa connections to the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. I'll talk with a professor from the University of Iowa and a biologist from Ducks Unlimited. They're doing different things to preserve the ecosystem in the Gulf. That and more on The Exchange, right after this news from NPR. From Iowa Public Radio News, this is The Exchange. I'm Alex Hoyer, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. Later in the show, we're going to talk about Iowa connections to the BP oil spill, but first, an update about the flooding situation in Des Moines. Within the last half hour, we've learned that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is delaying when it will release water from Sailorville Lake into the Des Moines River, and that's going to be tomorrow morning. I'm joined now by Bill Stowe, the director of the Des Moines Public Works Department. Bill Stowe, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Alex.
First of all, is this good news for you that the Army Corps of Engineers is delaying when it will release that water?
Well, the impact hopefully will be lesser, because the reason they're delaying it is the modeling of inflow into the reservoir indicates that the inflow numbers are less than they'd originally forecast. That means, among other things, the timing of uncontrolled release from Sailorville to us changes, but it's still an uncontrolled release, probably at a lesser volume than was originally impacted. But reality is that we're still looking at a situation where they have to use their emergency spillway process to release almost 40,000 cubic feet of water per second to us. So that the timing changes a little bit, the outcome. The rougher edges may be taken off a little bit, but any time we have an uncontrolled release of water from the Sailorville Reservoir down the Des Moines River to the city of Des Moines, that's a major concern for us.
So talk a little bit about what you're expecting when that water is going through that uncontrolled release.
And the timing for that now looks like the Corps' process will have water coming to the city of Des Moines about 24 hours from now, midday tomorrow, maybe early afternoon tomorrow. The concern is that that'll significantly raise the already swollen river levels here in Des Moines, and it'll cause stress on levees that we know are a particular problem. Birdland, which is an area that failed in 2008 and even in 1993, in the Central Place area, which did not fail in 2008, but was certainly stressed. So our concern is that anytime we face that uncontrolled release of water from Sailorville, it creates stress on our levees and the potential for significant flooding of commercial and residential areas that are near the Birdland and Central Place levees.
Do you think that the levees are going to be strong enough to hold back the water?
Alec, the reality is that we don't know, and that's the real issue. Certainly in a normal circumstance, even though these are levees with significant histories of problems, we don't have a worry about the levees failing when they're under this kind of stress. We just simply don't know. We've taken a number of precautions. We've looked at where their levees failed in 2008, and we've looked at the existing conditions out there and built a secondary line of protection, a levee behind the levee, if you will. But that's limited to an area that we think is of the highest risk. Some other areas that we think the levee is showing some signs of stress, we've done additional work to put a sand blanket and clay blanket to try and shore up sagging or under stress areas of the levee. But in reality, we're talking about several miles of levee, and our ability to be able to rebuild the levee independently of a process we've begun many years ago simply doesn't exist. So we've taken some proactive measures. We certainly are confident that if the levee fails in the area that we would anticipate it would fail in, that our measures will reduce damage. But at the end of the day, this is several miles of levee with a lot of pressure. We have, in the Des Moines area, seen high river levels since the spring melt off of snow, really around St. Patrick's Day. We were almost at an emergency flooding circumstance, and then the rivers went down, but have never gone down to any real sense of normalcy. So we continue to fight that throughout the last several months. We've just reached a point now where, with an emergency release at Sailorville, what already was a stressed condition becomes very stressed.
You have been quoted as saying that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers probably could have done a better job in gradually releasing the water. What do you think that should have been done?
Well, the long and short of it, Alex, is that the Army Corps of Engineers has, first, a very difficult and complex job. They don't only manage Sailorville, but they manage Red Rock and they manage Coralville. And Sailorville and the Red Rock system are interconnected both on the Des Moines River, so decisions they make have to look at a bigger picture than the city of Des Moines. I certainly understand that. But their operating plan has a normal pool elevation at about 836 feet that we would believe they should make every effort to try and stay near in their management of the reservoir. Unfortunately, we have been well over 850 feet above sea level, 860 feet above sea level for really all spring. And my point is, in raising the comment about the Corps' management, we are downstream users that are very much at risk when there is an aggressive attempt to create storage at the reservoir, because the storage gets used up as it did in this circumstance, and we suffer from an emergency release that, frankly, our levees are not built to withstand, and we believe should be managed in a way that tries to reduce those risks. We've seen three of those in the last 17 years, now in 2010, in 2008, and then in 1993, and in each case, they resulted in significant property damage to us as a downstream community.
Mm-hmm. And with this, whether there is flooding or not, are there any evacuations planned? There was a story a couple days ago about the Department of Human Services, the State Department of Human Services, relocating some workers in a downtown building. Is there any evacuations going on as far as you're aware?
There are not evacuations that are requested on behalf of the city. Mayor County, as the mayor of the city of Des Moines, has emergency powers to implement evacuation orders. We're certainly not at that point. We're trying to provide information to our residents that lets them go through their own risk calculation. If we thought, that is the city thought, that there was an imminent risk of damage to property or risk to people, we would issue an evacuation order as we did in 2008. We're just not seeing that at this point. We hope to avoid that. But there are a number of folks who've looked at their own experiences and their own tolerance for risk and moved to higher ground, or what I think is probably more typical is a number of folks in this area have protected their personal property, particularly at lower elevations, and are waiting it out. They're going to see what happens and be listening to the media in the event that there is a need to emergency evacuate.
Mm-hmm. And you've been talking about the flood of 2008, that there were evacuations then. Just try to put what's going on now, the situation. There's a lot of breaking news about it, but try to put it in perspective for us. What are you expecting, perhaps compared to 2008? Not extremely as bad as what happened then?
Certainly with the measures we've taken, and the measures we have taken really are the luxury of time. The Corps of Engineers has done a great job of communicating several days ago the likelihood of this emergency release. That gives us an opportunity to do things like build secondary line of protection and shore up the levee system and work on evacuation plans in the event they're necessary, do a number of things in terms of preparation. We didn't have that luxury in 2008. And in 2008, we were fighting local high intense rains that we're not seeing here. This water is coming to us from outstate, from northern Iowa and southern Minnesota, working through the Des Moines River Valley. We don't have problems on the Raccoon River, which we did have in 2008, all of which is to say that the level of risk and the focus of flood fighting here is far more narrow. Certainly, if the levee breaches in either the Birdland or the Central Place areas or in some other area, that would provide intense property damage, our greatest risk and our greatest concern is to make sure that people aren't hurt or killed in this kind of circumstance. But it really is not very comparable to 2008, other than the triggering event here, besides rain, which obviously is the triggering event as we look now about a week past into last weekend, where intense rains here in Des Moines and then throughout the Des Moines River Valley. The triggering event is an emergency release from Sailorville. We've only had that on two occasions before this, and on each of those occasions it triggered a failure or an overtopping of our levee system.
All right. Bill Stowe, Public Works Director for the City of Des Moines, thanks for taking the time today.
Alex, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you. And now we go to our other topic for today. We're going to be talking about Iowa connections to the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Millions of gallons of oil have gone into the ocean after the explosion of the Deepwater Horizon on April 20th, when 11 people died. In the second half of the show, we'll talk about a new exhibit at the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque that depicts what's going on in the Gulf. But for the rest of this first half hour, I'm joined by two guests who are studying and trying to protect the fragile ecosystem along the coast and the wildlife that lives there, including the birds that migrate from Iowa and Minnesota and go south. First, Tom Moorman. He's the Director of Conservation Planning for Ducks Unlimited Southern Region and the organization's chief biologist in the region. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Alex.
All right. And I'm also joined by Jerry Schnorr, a professor of civil and environmental engineering and professor of occupational and environmental health at the University of Iowa. He joins me from our studios in Iowa City. Welcome to you.
Thanks, Alex.
All right. We have to take a break in just about a minute here, but I want to start with you, Jerry. Explain what you're doing in the Gulf, what you're researching.
My students and I are working with Louisiana State University and others there to try to understand if the marshes die as a result of oil toxicity, what might be done in order to replace them. And our specialty here at the University of Iowa has to do with phytoremediation, using plants to help clean up contaminants like oil spills.
Mm-hmm. And what exactly is a marsh?
A marsh is it's a very unique ecosystem in Louisiana, comprised of grasses, almost a sea of grass, in very shallow water, which serves as a nursery for shrimp and crabs and small fish. It's really rich ecologically.
So a very wet environment?
Yes, mm-hmm. Extremely wet.
Great. All right. We are going to get to more of the University of Iowa's efforts down in the Gulf of Mexico. And when we come back from our break, we're going to start talking with Tom Moorman, the Director of Conservation Planning for Ducks Unlimited, their southern region. We'll be back in about a minute here on Iowa Public Radio. We're back with The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. My guests for this, for the next 10 minutes or so, Jerry Schnorr at the University of Iowa and Tom Moorman with Ducks Unlimited. Tom Moorman, thanks for being with us today. Just briefly talk to us about what Ducks Unlimited is doing to try to prevent the damage caused by this oil spill.
Okay. Well, the first thing that we did was mostly we're trying to get information out about what's at stake here relative to the spill. Louisiana's faced over decades some pretty significant coastal marsh loss, about 1 million acres or a little more than that actually since probably the 1930s. The spill will potentially exacerbate that. You heard Dr. Schnorr talk about if the vegetation is killed by the oil, wetland loss could be greatly accelerated. In response to that, one of the things we're working on with National Fish and Wildlife Foundation is to flood at least this fall and winter some agricultural habitat that is adjacent to the coastal marshes in South Louisiana and coastal Texas that offer some alternative habitats for birds that might be displaced if the scale of this thing spreads to the point that it impacts a lot of waterfowl habitat.
Mm-hmm. And you're specifically working with the migration of birds, so birds that would be going south for the winter from Minnesota, from Iowa, from other states around here. What is the specific concern about those birds that would be going south?
Well, there will really be two or three things that we're concerned about. It varies a good bit among species. For waterfowl, there are some species like lesser scaup that winter just offshore of coastal Louisiana, southeast Louisiana. Just offshore, there's between 250,000 and 1.4 million scaup. It's about 30 or 40% of the continent's population. Those birds would be at risk of oiling if oil slicks are still present when they get there this fall. Their food sources could also be killed, in which case they'll need to disperse, or their food sources could become contaminated, and they might ingest some toxins. Then the other threat is if we get a big hurricane or tropical storm that brings a storm surge loaded with oil into those sensitive marshes, especially the fresh and intermediate salinity areas, then the vegetation could be killed. Short term, that means no waterfowl food. Long term, it might mean death of the vegetation and conversion to open water.
Mm-hmm. And with the birds coming down, what kind of birds are specifically that we're talking about that are going to be in danger?
Well, of course, Louisiana winters up to about 9 million ducks each year. Varies a little bit among years. Another 1.5 million geese. Then there's just a plethora of wading birds, shore birds, some other secretive marsh birds like rails. So millions and millions of birds will be down there. The real question is how much oil infiltrates the marshes where most of them will be spending the winter.
Mm-hmm. And before I turn to Jerry Schnorr from the University of Iowa, you mentioned that the food source could be contaminated. Will the birds, when they're coming down, will they try to land where their normal habitat will be, or will they notice that their habitat is damaged and try to go someplace else?
Most likely they're going to go to their traditional places. We're seeing, you see now on TV some of the local resident nesting species like brown pelicans are encountering oil. Birds are pretty conditioned to go to these places, have been for thousands and thousands of years, so they're probably going to go there. So the question will be, when they get there, what will they find? And that will dictate sort of our responses. If there's lots of oil present, then trying to capture and rehabilitate birds or keep them away from oil by providing alternative habitats will become increasingly important.
Mm-hmm. And let me turn to you, Jerry Schnorr. When we're talking about the habitat of the wildlife, either migration or just the general habitat for the wildlife that's down there, you're specifically working so that when that habitat is damaged, that you could potentially restore it in the future.
That's right. We're interested in a couple different questions. One is what level of oiling will be toxic to the native grasses. There's one in particular, a salt marsh grass called Spartina, which comprises a large fraction of the coastal marshes there. And we would determine that in the laboratory. So we've actually brought back samples of the sediments and grasses, and we can order it also, these plugs of grass, and oil it ourselves and see what the special sensitivity is of the marshland. Also, we're interested in the question about what's the rate of biodegradation? How rapidly will, once oiled, how rapidly will the marshes tend to cleanse themselves by biodegradation? The microbes, especially in the root zone and sediments of the plants, degrade the oil. And so we're interested in knowing that question to try to understand how long, to what extent time-wise will this be a problem? If everything would die, as Tom Moorman said, then we'd be interested in questions like, could we burn the remaining grasses, burn off the oil, replant it either with a new species that was very fast at biodegrading the oil, and then eventually coming back in with the native grasses again. But gosh, they're losing something like 50 acres a year of marshes already in coastal Louisiana due to other processes. So we're really hoping that this won't result in a massive loss of habitat, as Tom Orman said.
Mm-hmm. So, Tom, this is not a new problem. The oil spill has just accelerated it, really.
That's correct. This has been going on for decades. It has to do with lots of complicated reasons, but ultimately it's the confinement of the Mississippi River. It's been confined by levees, and so the water and sediment of its don't get into its floodplain, and those are the things that actually built those marshes in the first place. Since the levees have been constructed and combined with all the other things that are going on, we lose anywhere in the neighborhood of about 16,000 to 20,000 acres of coastal wetlands a year in Louisiana alone. So it's a pretty serious problem. Ongoing, people all over the country need to understand what's happening down there, because those wetlands are important for a host of reasons beyond those that are just local in nature.
Mm-hmm. We've been hearing from politicians down there. The president has said that still go to the Gulf, still go there for vacation, because the area is losing a lot of tourism dollars. How do we draw the balance between this extreme environmental devastation and whether it's safe to go down there?
Is that one? I'll take that one, I guess, since
yes,
I'm down
Tom
here.
Orman, yes,
Tom Orman, yes. What you find, so far anyway, is that when the oil comes ashore, it's in pretty isolated locations. For instance, in coastal Louisiana, most of the oil has hit in Barataria Bay and two barrier islands, one called Grand Isle, the other called Grand Terre Isle. If you go to the east, some of the beaches in Alabama and Florida have been hit. Generally speaking, they're cleaned up pretty quickly. And, you know, the local authorities have been really good about advising whether it's safe to swim or you should avoid swimming, those kinds of things. And the seafood's all being carefully tested and monitored. So really the concerns are being very well managed on that on that side of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Jerry Schnorr, have you been able to get any results from the samples that were collected by your students?
No, not yet. We're just beginning experimentation in the laboratory, so it's too early to say, Alex. But I did want to correct something. I think I said earlier that the coastal Louisiana marshes are already losing 50 acres per year, and I meant to say 50 acres per day. So it's really a dramatic loss of habitat, and we can't afford any more. And we hope that a natural solution is using plants to help clean up the mess, and hopefully they won't die in the first place.
Mm-hmm. You're considered widely to be an environmental expert. What do you think that this BP oil spill tells the United States about this dependence on fossil fuels that we seem to have? Is this incident indicative of a larger issue in about 20 seconds or so?
Well, my own feeling is that it should at least give us pause. Is it reasonable for a small, relatively small amount of oil to be drilling miles beneath the surface of the ocean to get oil when, for example, maybe 3 to 5 miles per gallon better fuel efficiency in our cars would obviate the need for the oil in the first place? We're putting an entire ecosystem at risk.
Okay, we have to leave the conversation there. I'd like to thank both of my guests, Jerry Schnorr from the University of Iowa and Tom Orman with Ducks Unlimited. Thank you for both of you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we'll be back in about 5 minutes. Welcome back to The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Alex Hoyer in for Ben Kiefer. Today we're continuing our conversation about Iowa connections to the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. On April 20th, BP's Deepwater Horizon rig exploded, killing 11 people. Since then, millions of gallons of oil have gushed into the Gulf and washed onto the shores of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida. The National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque has received a lot of attention for its new exhibit depicting the oil spill in the Gulf. The exhibit opened this past weekend, and in the interest of full disclosure, the Museum and Aquarium is an underwriter of programming on Iowa Public Radio. But now I'm joined by the museum's executive director, Jerry Ensler. Welcome to the program, Jerry.
Well, thank you very much.
We'd also like to invite you, the listener, to our conversation. Have you seen the new exhibit? What were your thoughts about it? Or should an entire exhibit be devoted to the topic rather than an aquarium full of the marine life of the Mississippi River? Give us a call at 1-866-780-9100. That's 866-780-9100. You can send us an email at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. And you can also find us on Twitter at IPRTalk. Jerry, set the ground rules for us. Explain what the new exhibit is all about there at the Museum and Aquarium.
Well, it is it's a very stunning part of our new campus. It's a multi-million-dollar exhibit that we had planned and will indeed in the future use to show the biological life of the Gulf of Mexico region. But with the Gulf oil explosion and the spill, we just started to think more and more about what our educational responsibilities were, and how we could make a stronger statement. So, our choice was in our primary galley aquarium, which is a 40,000 gallon tank, plus we have two smaller Gulf of Mexico tanks, that we would open depicting a lifeless Gulf, and that we would have a graphic representation of oil that's a graphic that's put on the acrylic viewing window so that you can see a little bit of what it would be like to be underwater in the Gulf of Mexico where the fish are gone and the oil is taking over.
So what's the first thing that someone walking into the room would actually see? Would they see this big tank? What would they actually see there?
Yeah, the first thing they'll see is a very large tank, beautifully lit. The acrylic viewing window is 12 feet high by 32 feet across. There are 40,000 gallons of water in this tank. And there is an artificial representation, a very colorful representation of the coral reefs that are, in the Gulf of Mexico. But then when they look at the acrylic viewing window, they see for the first two-thirds of it, from the top down to the bottom third, there's a graphic representation of the kind of caramel-colored oil, which is the color it typically is showing itself as in the Gulf. And so they see this, they're looking through the oil representation, and they aren't seeing any animals, and they are seeing a representation of the coral. Ours is a facsimile, but in the wild, this coral is alive. And so we're presenting kind of a kinetic moment where it's a still moment, but it's the moment of where the oil is about to cover the coral and kill the coral.
Mm. You mentioned that you thought it was your educational duty as a museum to really depict what was going on now. At what point did you make that decision to scrap the original plans that you had?
Well, it's a couple factors led to that. First was that someone wrote a letter to our local editor, in the paper, who said, the Museum and Aquarium should consider adding oil to its new Gulf of Mexico aquarium. And it was just a tongue-in-cheek comment, but it really got us thinking. And the other factor was that, frankly, we weren't going to be ready with all of our aquariums until probably mid-July. And so the question was, do we, stop and, not open until July 15th, or do we take this opportunity and open the rest of the National River Center and open these tanks representing a lifeless Gulf? And so that was really our choice. We do have animals now. We're ready to go, but we just think it's caught on. It's become so popular and it's such an important statement that we want to maintain this for a few days more.
How much more time do you plan to maintain it?
Well, we're going to be adding some of the wildlife from the Gulf gradually. In fact, we may add a few smaller animals, some small conos rays tomorrow, and so and a few of the bony fish like the lookdowns and some of the others. We won't be adding the big sharks or the moray eel until a later time. So the exhibit evolves. So we start with a depiction of a lifeless Gulf, and then we start to see some of the fish swimming around or through the graphic representation of the oil spill. The exhibit itself will remain up, you know, for 1 month from June 26th to July 26th. But in the month of July, animals will be gradually added and it will become more and more populated. And that's not necessarily saying that the Gulf is having a rebound. It's just we just want to depict both a lifeless Gulf and depict fish as if they're swimming through the oil spill. It's a unique opportunity. It's rare that you get an opportunity to present a $2 million exhibit with nothing in it, except a beautiful display of water and coral, and then the threatening disaster of the oil.
Mm-hmm. And you were talking about how the exhibit is going to evolve. I understand that there's this map of the Mississippi River, and it features a graphic of the oil spill, and that it will grow as the disaster widens. Are there still plans to continue that?
Yes, there are. Yeah, we'll be doing that through the month. We might even continue that beyond. We have several representations of North America, you know, including the Gulf of Mexico, and it's quite alarming, of course, how far the oil can spread, and it's being picked up by the Gulf Stream, and the Gulf Stream is you might even call it a river within the ocean. It comes from the coast of Texas and goes across the northern Gulf. It goes to the panhandle of Florida. It goes around Florida, and then this Gulf Stream continues to go up the Atlantic coast, and then it heads west to Europe, east to Europe. And this is a Gulf Stream that's been known, by scientists and others for a long, long time. I mean, Benjamin Franklin was measuring the effect of the Gulf Stream as he was traveling back and forth on sailing ships in his day. But this same Gulf Stream, is threatening to carry oil, considerable distances.
Mm-hmm. We all know that the Mississippi River, of course, goes empties out into the Gulf. But what is the more direct link between having the Mississippi River up in Dubuque and having a museum about the Mississippi River? What is the more direct link between the actual river and the oil spill?
Well, the link for us is that the theme of our new National River Center is the primary exhibit is called Rivers to the Sea. And the message that we've been working on for the past 5 years and what we opened with our new National River Center on Saturday is that the oceans begin at the mountaintops is one way of saying it. We are all a source for the river. Most people think of Lake Itasca as the source for the Mississippi, but frankly, whatever we ingest into our bodies and what comes off our rain gutters also becomes a source for the Mississippi River. 31 states contribute to the Mississippi River, and the river pours into the Gulf at the rate of 3.3 million gallons a second. So there's an enormous connection. There's no way they can be separated. And from our mission statement, what we've done for the Mississippi River for the past 7 years with our Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium, we now want to do for the rivers of the nation with our National River Center. And this message of rivers to the sea. Anything you do on land comes to the river. Anything you do in the river goes to the ocean.
Mm-hmm. When you were building this exhibit about the oil spill, did you have to reach out to anybody, any other organizations? Did you talk to people in the Gulf? Or how did you go about setting up the actual display and the information?
We talked to people from NOAA, for example, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and we have a long partnership with them. We talked to our partners in Coastal America. It relates to your earlier question. Dubuque, Iowa is one of the 24 aquariums that are part of Coastal America. And why? Well, because the, you know, the watershed of the Mississippi is so vast that it has a huge impact on the coast. So we talked to our colleagues at other aquariums. We talked to some people at the Aquarium of the Americas in New Orleans, the Aquarium of the Pacific in Long Beach. Also, are some research associates at Dolphin Island, which is in near Mobile, Alabama, and then we also visited with some people we know in the commercial industry. You know, about what's going on there. We have friends who are at the Port of New Orleans. And so we talked with a number of them. One of our primary nonprofit partners is the Coalition to Restore Coastal Louisiana. And this coalition has been underway for at least 10 years, and we serve on their board of directors. But it's really a coalition of organizations. There's probably over 60 organizations that have been working for the past decade to try and stop the loss of coastal wetlands, to try and replenish the bayous with the rich sediment that used to flow from our Iowa shores to their bayous, but they don't reach it now because of the levees. And so we're encouraging people to call the Coalition to Restore Coastal Louisiana to volunteer to help out in rescuing animals or contributing funds or any other way they could help.
Mm-hmm. And if you're just joining us, my guest for the next 10 minutes or so is Jerry Ensler, the executive director of the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque. The museum and aquarium there has a new exhibit that's depicting the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. What kind of reactions, Jerry, have you been receiving from people who have viewed this new exhibit?
Overwhelmingly positive, but that's not to say that some children are a little disappointed because they were hoping to see some sharks on that day. But we've been careful to make it clear, especially when families are coming in, that we say that this exhibit is a very important exhibit, but there will not be any fish on display in the Gulf tank this week and into next week, for example. So there's been some expression of disappointment, but there's been marvelous expression of congratulations. I've heard from, you know, I didn't realize that when AP picked up the story, it would go so broad, but I've heard from friends in Boston and in Washington State and Washington, D.C., who've all read it in their local newspapers. I've heard from people I don't know, like a woman from Pensacola sent me an email and congratulated us, and she said, "We just feel like we're forgotten down here, and to know that someone up there in Iowa is thinking about us and is caring and is helping educate about what's happening, that's very, very important." And then I've heard from people in Iowa, in Des Moines and Ames and Cedar Rapids, they've called and told me, "This is just another example of how Iowa really gets it, how Iowa can be so proud of what it does, how Iowa takes the higher road." We're very gratified by that because it's a very serious issue, obviously, and an exhibit doesn't solve the issue in any means, but it raises awareness, and our messages are relatively simple. We want people to be aware, to talk about their point of view with their friends and their leaders. We want them to conserve energy, to reduce dependence on fossil fuels, and to reduce energy consumption, and to volunteer and or send funds.
Mm-hmm. If you'd like to join our conversation, you, the listener, feel free to give us a call, 1-866-780-9100. Have you seen this new exhibit? What were your thoughts about it? Or do you want to see it? Maybe you don't want to see it. Maybe you're tired of all the media attention about the BP oil spill. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Send us an email at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. You can find us on Twitter at IPR Talk. Jerry, is there any fear that, like I asked in my question, that people might be really tired of hearing about the BP oil spill? It's been going on since April 20th. Is there a fear that will mean that people won't want to come to the museum?
Well, I don't think so. Well, first of all, the museum itself already is a 2 to 3 hour experience. What we did on Saturday actually is we doubled the size of the museum. We built we took an existing building, 50,000 square feet. We put $8 million of new exhibits into that facility. So there's a tremendous exhibit called River Ways, which has a canal theater, a waterfall, a big map exhibition show. There's the Rivers of the Sea exhibit, which we've been talking about, which has a number of other interactives and learning about our blue planet and water conservation. There's a Riverworks Splash Zone, which is a hands-on activity play space for families. And there's a new 3D, 4D theater. So there's a very rich variety of experiences, particularly for the Gulf. It's still the tank itself actually is quite beautiful. It's a stunning blue color, and the bottom of the tank has the habitat of the coral reef, and this is a meticulously painted, very accurate depiction of coral. And so, even without any animals in it at all, it's actually a gorgeous tank to view. And then there's two smaller tanks. One shows the Florida seagrass beds, and one shows another part of the floral of the coral reef, the flower garden banks. And so these habitat of even of themselves are really quite attractive. And that's one of the points we wanted to make, is that what aquariums show is not only just the animals, we show the habitat. And the other one is that a lot of people, we who live on top of the earth, we tend to focus on what is visible to us. So turtles wash up on shore, so we're concerned about turtles. And we can see the birds, and they're preening themselves, and they're dying because they're ingesting the oil. So we're concerned about that. We're concerned about tar balls and what that does to the beach. There hasn't been very much conversation about what this is doing to the fish. Fish are, they're dying by ingesting the oil through their gills. Some fish are becoming blinded by the oil, and so therefore they are an easy prey to predators. There's almost a virtual graveyard on the bottom of some areas of the northern Gulf because the plankton and a lot of the other bottom-dwelling creatures are dying, and that affects the chain of life, the food chain. And so there's an enormous impact on fish that's virtually invisible and almost unspoken of. In this whole BP oil issue.
Sure. We have a call from Pat calling us from Ames. Welcome to the program, Pat.
Good afternoon.
What's your comment or question?
Well, I really want to compliment the director on his perspective of how Iowans are viewing this Gulf tragedy. I also have a privilege of working with Peregrine Falcons, and they just so happens there's a pair occupying your Wisconsin bridge there in Dubuque. But in the autumn, when these peregrines, the young of the year, migrate, a lot of them are destined to go to the Gulf. And I feel we'll have some programs in Clinton County that will discuss our messengers, if you will, that hopefully they'll return, but boy, they're going into harm's way. And these large corporations that extract, you know, literally billions from international waters, and then with the dispersants, and you're mentioning the phytoplankton, and they, this whole food chain is going to be affected. But now that the peregrine falcons are no longer endangered, they were certainly still in harm's way. And I think these sort of practices that create these tragedies is it's just unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
What we're tolerating here, and these large corporations are going to have to plow some of those profits back into maintenance of the environment, or else this will reoccur and reoccur. So mm-hmm. What they're doing there at the aquarium in Dubuque is right on target.
All right. Thanks for your call today, Pat, from Ames. Thank you very much. Jerry Ensler, what you're doing, whether we're talking about migration of birds or we're talking about this, all these education efforts, and you kind of alluded to this earlier, but it seems that museums oftentimes struggle to stay current, to attract people to wonder what the relevance is. Why should they be looking into history, or why should they be looking at some habitat? Is this more of an attempt by the museum and aquarium to really stay relevant when there's so many things these days that distract and take our attention away from maybe a museum or an aquarium?
Absolutely. And that's something that we had a major turning point, I'd say, in 2003 when we went from the Mississippi River Museum to the Museum and Aquarium. You know, we actually have these live habitats showing fish as they are in the wild, and suddenly that changes people's perspective. And you'll find more about the river and the ocean as it is today than it is in the past. But even sometimes today, I mean, I use the expression, you know, sometimes an aquarium can kind of look like a screensaver. You see these beautiful fish going by, but you say, well, so what? I mean, they're pretty, but what's the bigger message? And so this is a message delivery, and it's not as pretty. We think it's actually more important to talk about the Gulf spill than it is to show people. And you know, and I've heard comments. You know, when I see people viewing, we always try to bring out a positive perspective. But sometimes people just comment on the color of the fish, for example. Mm-hmm. And there's so much more to learn. And so that's what we try to do. We also have a Coastal America kiosk, which has a live update every night from the Smithsonian Institution.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same scientific information that the Smithsonian is presenting in its Museum of Natural History every day.
Right.
And so we really stay current in that way, too.
Okay, great. Well, we have to leave it there. Jerry Ensler, Executive Director of the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Dennis Reese. Production assistance today from Christoph Mai. Podcasting and on-demand audio from The Exchange is available by going to our website, iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Alex Hoyer. Thanks for joining us.